We have already considered the doctrine of informed consent in its development from the progressive 19th century idolization of science and then of medicine to a very paternalistic model that prevailed at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries, in which it was naively presumed that physicians can always be trusted, and in which physicians also presumed that patients were to be utterly compliant and subservient. In our survey of the development of medical bioethics, we noted the significance of the Nuremberg trials for the development of the doctrine of informed consent as it's understood today. However, our approach at that time was to consider the Nuremberg trials as a kind of a watershed, as a moment when suddenly the world realized that the rather naive 19th and early 20th century notions of the complete trustability, as it were, of the medical profession, the fact that one could utterly rely upon physicians to always act in patients' best interests, this principle could not be relied upon. That an entire generation, an entire nation of healthcare workers had gone over to the Nazi Party politics and programs and thus perverted the practice of medicine in ways that could only dimly be comprehended and which in fact were not believed until incontrovertible proof was produced at the trials. We noted that this was a moment when things changed and when this earlier notion of paternalism, the presumption that one can always trust one's healthcare workers in a kind of fatherly sort of way, and conversely, that the physician has the right to expect utter compliance and subservience on the part of the patient, faded and was replaced by the expectation, the absolute expectation, as it's understood today, that informed consent would be the basis of all medical practice. Now, at Nuremberg, it was not the question of all medical practice that was the consideration, but rather the issue of experimentation on human subjects. And so the Nuremberg principles, as we'll see them and review them again, refer specifically to procedures that are at the edge of medical research. Informed consent today means the absolute necessity, at least in the United States, of obtaining free and completely informed consent. That is, patients must be informed about the significance of, the likely side effects of, the alternatives to treatment by, and the significance and potential effects of alternative treatments for any medical procedure that is being recommended. And so the kind of informed consent concerning medical experimentation that we will see as the subject both of the Nuremberg trials and then the statements by Pope Pius XII evolve through the 1940s, 50s, and then into the 70s into a doctrine which becomes extremely widespread and broadly applied and then is understood as applying to everything that physicians do in a non-emergent way, in settings where the patient cannot simply be presumed to cooperate in virtue of the fact that the patient is unconscious or the treatment must be applied immediately lest the patient die. That in any other context, completely free and informed consent is required for everything that is done by a physician, everything that is done in a hospital. We'll be looking now at the beginnings of this evolution, the spread and adaptation of this doctrine, by reminding ourselves of what it was that took place at Nuremberg and noting the principles that were articulated there. I've prefaced this text with a little introduction that describes much of what we've said, concluding with the rather blunt but accurate statement that today in the United States, any non-emergent medical treatment that is performed without the patient's consent may constitute a crime that can be prosecuted, and not merely as medical malpractice, but in fact as assault. So informed consent is required before all procedures that carry any kind of risk. Again, here at Nuremberg, what we are seeing is not the question of general medical care, but of experimentation. Now, there is a very important overlap, and that is that one of the things which the doctors in Germany did was to misuse the physician-patient relationship, the relationship that was and still is, of course, based on trust that the individual is trained and that the individual has one's best interests at heart. The shock that eventually recoiled through the entire world, and especially through the medical community, was the discovery that this relationship had been betrayed and even manipulated in ways that allowed physicians to acquire some kind of compliance over patients whom they knew they were harming. A real perversion and twisting of this relationship, which is so essential in the area of acquiring anything like free and informed consent. So if we drop down to the picture of the Nuremberg trials and of Goering at his giving his testimony, and then to the introduction, this text is taken from the official government transcript of a description of an introduction to the proceedings of the Nuremberg trials, and they provide a context both for the strange and difficult issue of legal precedent, of which there really was none, and the question of the issues themselves considered at Nuremberg. The question of legal precedent was, of course, the fact that one had people being held accountable for actions which, as we've mentioned before, were paradoxically technically not illegal in their nation. Many of the laws which were followed in the euthanasia practices under National Socialism had, in fact, been approved by the legislature, by the electorate, indirectly. And so the question was how to convict people of crimes when, in fact, what they had done in their own country was not regarded as a crime. And the concept of crimes against humanity, of there existing a broad and overreaching system of ethics that applies irregardless of what one happens to believe or vote in one's own country, was the basis for the Nuremberg trials. That there is a common human morality to which one can appeal, and that the principles that are articulated from Nuremberg in regard to experimentation are an expression of this fundamental human morality that allows one to define such a thing as crimes against humanity. And under 3.1, the introduction, I've highlighted the text that the prosecutors note that criminal medical experiments were conducted on not only non-German nationals, prisoners of war, civilians, especially on Jews and persons who were defined as being asocial, and that this was done both in Germany and in the occupied countries. And if you drop down below the photographs, the pictures of Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria, a very infamous location where medical experimentation was performed, the prosecutors at Nuremberg conclude, and I've highlighted that there were in fact coordinated policy making and planning at high governmental, military, and Nazi Party levels, that this experimentation was something specifically not only endorsed but really induced by the government. Now, there is the acknowledgement in this section that's highlighted or titled Permissible Medical Experiments that there is such a thing as medical experimentation that needs to take place. This is one of the great difficulties involved in any national health program of reimbursement, that there will always be medical therapies that have not yet been proven to be fully effective but which have to be tested in order for medicine to make any progress. It is impossible to determine what will work unless one tries these things. And as the Nuremberg trial emphasizes, one does one's best to determine that it works in animal models and in all the laboratory models that one can find. But ultimately, there comes a point when it's necessary to try procedures and drugs on human beings in order to determine whether or not they will help people. This is the way medicine simply advances, and it cannot be abolished or done away with. So there is such a thing as permissible medical experimentation, but as the concluding sentence points out, all agree that certain basic principles must be observed to satisfy moral, ethical, and legal concepts, and these are the 10 principles of the Nuremberg Code. We've gone over them before. We can look at them again very briefly now. And the first principle is that of voluntary consent. And it is not only voluntary, but it is informed. If you look down at the text that I've highlighted in red, the individual must have sufficient knowledge and comprehension of the elements of the subject matter involved. Specifically, this requires that before the acceptance of an affirmative decision by the experimental subject, there should be made known to him the nature, duration, and purpose of the experiment, the method and means by which it is to be conducted, all inconveniences and hazards reasonably to be expected, and the effects upon one's health or person that may possibly come from participation in this experiment. So it is both voluntary, that is to say, free consent, and it is informed consent. The person must know what it is that they are agreeing to. And then the experiment should be such as to be expected to yield fruitful results. Nothing trivial, nothing frivolous. One has to have good reasons for believing that this experiment will yield results. It should have been tested in the laboratory and on animals before it's applied to human beings, and number three. Number four, it should be conducted so as to avoid any physical or mental suffering or injury that can possibly be avoided. And in number five, there should be no such thing as an experiment where there is the possibility of death or disabling injury unless the physicians themselves are willing to serve as subjects. And in number six, I should add that in regard to number five, the church would have serious problems with this, as we'll see, because the church does not believe that individuals have the right to sacrifice themselves except for very, very good reasons in ways that would significantly compromise their physical or emotional integrity. So nothing trivial can be undertaken, and particularly in this idea of death or disabling injury, it's not a question simply of having consent, but of having the moral right to do that. In number six, the humanitarian importance of the problem, that is, the results that can be expected, should be such as to outweigh whatever risk or inconvenience the experiment would induce. Number seven, preparations should be made to protect the subject against even remote possibilities of injury, disability, or death. Eight, it should be conducted only by scientifically qualified persons. And then in number nine, the subject has the right to say, I'm done, we're stopping now. You are not obliged to continue simply because you signed up for it. And indeed, in number 10, the people conducting the procedure, the experiment, must be prepared to stop if there's good reason to believe that it's going to cause significant injury, disability, or death to the person. If it turns out that the study is going to be harmful, then no matter what the results you were anticipating, the study should be terminated. Now, we'll stop here in terms of looking at text, but I simply want to remind us that what we see here is primarily a system, a set of ethical guidelines that are concerned with the area of experimentation. But as we've mentioned, medical science advances by experimentation, and indeed, virtually all procedures, all things that are done in medicine, are done because there is a probability of success, because so far its use in certain settings has been proven to be beneficial. So in many ways, one could argue that virtually all medical procedures have an experimental quality to them. That is, data is continually being gathered that will be assessed and be considered in terms of whether or not these procedures should be considered in future. So the paradigm, the model of experimentation and free and informed consent really does apply to all aspects of medical care and should be, as it was over the next several decades after the Nuremberg trials, applied to every aspect of medical care. Everything that one does carries a certain risk. Everything that one does is done in a context of trying to figure out whether or not it works, and many procedures and practices are simply abandoned over time because it's determined that they're not as effective or successful as they were once thought to be. So we will continue now by moving on in our next section to consider the Church's affirmation and ratification of these principles under Pius XII.